AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Empire Podcast this week. You don't have to be Albert Einstein to figure out that we're delighted to be joined by Jeffrey Rush, the star of Genius, in which he plays Albert Einstein. Plus, usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. I would never want to watch a Jason Statham movie with John Fergo. Every 5 minutes, where's the cue ball going? It would get old really fast. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast, brought to you by mustard.co.uk, those wonderful chaps who make car insurance comparison so much easier than it is with other things that do that. That'll do. Couple of bits of housekeeping before we get into it this week. We have somehow, I don't know how, because lots of you have voted. We're in the final 20 for the Listener's Choice category at the British Podcast Awards, which take place next Saturday, the April 29th. Thanks so much to all of those who've voted for us thus far. And if you've come this far, then perhaps you're willing to go a little further, because we'd love to be in the final one. We know it is unlikely, because we're up against some incredible podcasts. Give you an idea of some of the other finalists in the final 20. Atletico Mints, which is the great Bob Mortimer podcast, football-related kind of. Distraction Pieces podcast with Scroobius Pip. Dumpty Dum, a show about the Archers by its fans. Football Weekly, The Guardian. Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. What's that? Anyone know what that is? Ever heard of that? No,
just never heard of him.
Bunch of blokes whittering on about entertainment. Hello to Jason Isaacs. My dad wrote a porno. That's a big one. The Anfield Rap podcast. It's really good stuff. So if we somehow manage to triumph over that a little lot, that'd be amazing. And it would all be down to you guys, our wonderful listener. So if you haven't voted yet and you love, like, or even just have a mild tolerance built up over the last 5 years for what we do, please vote at www.com/ I'll do a full Brian Butterfield. www.britishpodcastawards.com/vote. There we go. Thank you very much indeed. And also, other bit of housekeeping. Last week I said we might have Warren Beatty on the show. And we do, but just not this one. Because I spoke to the legendary bloke himself earlier this week. It went so darn well and for so darn long that we've turned it into an interview special that should be out right about now as well, if we don't kill John Nugent with the editing. So please do listen to that as well, if you would. Thank you so much indeed. Housekeeping done. Right, okay. This week I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up, our quiet, brooding George Harrison looky likey. It's John Nugent.
Hello.
That's it. That's your intro this week.
Okay.
I haven't let through hoops or anything to do it. Sorry.
That's fine. That's it. I thought you might mention The Rock, but that's fine.
I didn't want to mention The Rock because it went a bit wrong, didn't it, with The Rock? I mean, you came out last week. You flew your flag for The Rock. You said you were The Rock's number one guy. And then what did he do? He retweeted Ali Plum.
Ali Plum, yes. Oof. Yeah.
Oh, formerly of this parish and now a big film cheese over at Radio 1.
He actually retweeted Ali twice.
Twice.
Which is double the pain.
Did he tweet Ali and then did Ali retweet him? Or, you know, it's all very... But he definitely tweeted. He did a tweet saying, "Hey, Ali Plum, you're my man." Or something along those lines.
And he did another one last night.
He retweeted Ali last night.
Look.
Right, that's it.
I know this because Ali keeps messaging me to tell me. I'm like, I know. But no, I mean, I dimly remember the high that I felt. The euphoria. And so I don't envy him.
This is so weird because I'm actually the only person in this room who's actually worked with The Rock, and by that I mean I hosted a press conference for G.I. Joe 2, so I have worked with The Rock in a professional capacity.
You are the pebble.
And yet he has never tweeted me.
No.
What's that about?
Look, I'm not going to call Ali Plum a candy ass. That's not what I'm going to do.
A fight between you and Ali Plum would be the most ineffectual thing. It would be two very weedy men.
Yeah,
yes. I wouldn't say you're weedy. I'd say both of you are possessed of a wiry strength.
we can run fast.
You're rangy. That's the word.
Both of you have got a very long reach.
This is unrelated completely, but I'm reading Alec Baldwin's
memoir. This is Nick Desemlian, by the way. This is Nick Desemlian.
Do you mind trying?
We are a professional podcast. We're up for the British
top 20 in the world.
5 years in, and we still haven't got the hang of introducing people before they speak. Anyways, our Jurassic World loving Ringo Starr lookalike, Nick Desemlian. How are you?
Peace and love. Peace and love,
peace
Chris.
And love. Peace and love. Love it, love it.
So I'm reading Alec Baldwin's memoirs at the moment, which has a really boring title. Nevertheless.
Really?
It's called...
It's not Baldwin-ing or anything like that.
It should be. It should be chapters of foreclosure. Always be... there's something there.
Yeah.
Always be reading. ABR. but anyway, it's got a boring title, but the book itself is pretty spicy. Uh-huh. Because it's basically a list of insults aimed at everyone that Alec Baldwin has ever had.
Does every chapter end with, needless to say, I had the last laugh?
It might as well have. But he gets angry about everyone. He gets angry about Oliver Stone. He gets angry about De Niro at one point.
Is it essentially Father Ted's acceptance speech for Golden Cleric?
Let's move on to twats.
But he's furious. But he writes... our description of you, John, just reminded me of his description of Harrison Ford. He has a little section on Harrison Ford. And Alec Baldwin refers to him as a little man, short, scrawny and wiry, whose soft voice sounds as if it's coming from behind a door. Which is just an amazing takedown. That's a great... I love that line about the voice, but he's pretty pissed off with Harrison Ford still.
Why?
For taking Jack Ryan off him.
Oh, right.
Apparently he tells the story that...
I don't think Harrison Ford...
Well, he tells this story. He says that Harrison Ford... there was a meeting with Harrison Ford to take the role of Jack Ryan for Patriot Games. Obviously, Baldwin had played the role in Hunt for the Red October. Mm-hmm. And... somebody said to Harrison Ford, well, Alec Baldwin is still kind of attached. And he went, I don't give a fuck. And then Baldwin heard about that. And so that's kicked off this rivalry, this beef.
He got Forded.
Yeah. Mm. There's that.
There's that. You forgot what you were talking about.
No, that was the story.
I was going to say, so is it you and Ali next week? We'll get Ali. You know, he hasn't been able to do the podcast since he moved on, but maybe we'll get him in just to have a fight, an audio fight between the two of you.
An audio fight?
Yeah. Judged by The Rock himself. That would be amazing.
You think it would be like The Rock versus Statham in Fast and Furious 7?
I think you guys will definitely team up in the 8th movie about you.
Do you think?
Yeah, when you realise you've been manipulated by a really evil, devious type, me, essentially.
Right.
Just trying to manoeuvre you both into a position.
They call him Cypher Hewitt.
Yeah. Here is our question, because that wasn't the question. Here's the question that we were going to tackle this week, and it's via email. It's from Madhava Smullen from Florida. And the question is, what's the funniest moment in a movie that leaves you helpless with laughter no matter how many times you watch it? Interesting.
I feel like there's some subtext to this question, really, which is... which films can you rewatch? Which comedy movies can you rewatch and they're still funny? Because once you've seen a joke, it sort of loses its power
True. I don't know if that's true.
Well, it depends on the joke, doesn't it? If it's a good joke, or if it's a good scene or something,
yep.
If there's a familiarity to it, then it can grow.
Well, the question is about specific moments. So
yep.
It's moments in movies that still make you laugh, yep. Even after you've seen the film 5 or 6 times. So yeah, I don't know. I have really specific memories of seeing certain things at the cinema that just destroyed me, and one of them is Austin Powers, the opening sequence where he's dancing down the dance. This is the first Austin Powers film where he's dancing down the street, mm-hmm. in London, and specifically the bit where they all stop dancing and this British Bobby walks up to them and then just joins in and starts busting moves, and
yes.
I just remember that absolutely killing me. Like, I don't think I've ever laughed as hard. Because nobody had seen Austin Powers before, and so you didn't know what the hell was going on at that point. But great character.
Great character from the British Bobby, played, of course, by Dustin Granular. No, I haven't IMDb'd that. I love Austin Powers. Yeah, these are sometimes there's comedies are like... just a warm hug that you want to return to constantly. And I'm always banging on this podcast about Top Secret, which in my opinion is the best soccer Abraham soccer movie, and there are just so many sequences in that still to this day destroy me. And yes, podcast drinking game fans, my wife, we love it.
What's your favourite? What's the bit in Top Secret that kills you?
Almost everything with Deja Vu, who's this amazing character played by Jim Carter. He's a member of the French Resistance in mid-1960s East Germany.
Of course he is.
Deja Vu is one of the great comedy idiots, and almost everything he does is absolutely amazing. And the moment the French Resistance hit the film, it goes up a notch. It's already insane. But you have these incredible visual gags. There's this amazing joke where we're on a train with Val Kilmer. First movie, Val Kilmer's first movie. Good way to start. And we're on a train with him and his manager. He's playing Nick Rivers. He's going to East Germany to play in a festival. And the train begins to pull away from the station. And then the camera pulls out to reveal that the train is staying still, but it's the station that's moving. It is one of the great visual gags in history. But the bit that absolutely destroys me, there's a character called Ducroix, and no, actually, this is Deja Vu. Sorry, my mistake. But my favourite moment is a Deja Vu moment. It's amazing. Where he sits down. Nick has had some bad news. You can probably relate with this, Nick. You're Nick, and you've had some.
I'm having some bad news right now.
Right, okay,
I'm
here we go.
This podcast.
So Nick's had some bad news, and Deja Vu sits him down and goes, "You know, Nick, life is filled with its little miseries. Each of us must learn to deal with adversity in a mature and adult manner." And then he sneezes into his hand, and he looks at the contents of his hand, and he goes, "Aah!" And he runs and he leaps out of a window. And that is, for me, the pinnacle of humour. Thank you very much indeed. Good night. Bye-bye.
It often is the dumbest stuff. Like, staying on the Zucker Abrams vibe, I'm a huge fan of Naked Gun 2.5.
Oh,
specifically 2.5.
Hmm.
I think it's superior to the first. I don't care what anyone
says.
You're
an idiot! It's a great film.
Yeah. But it's the scene that always slays me is Professor Meinheimer, who's just a great character played by Richard Griffith. Professor Meinheimer, and he's got that amazing doppelganger with
Is it the bit where he meets Frank Drebin for the first time, and Meinheimer's in a wheelchair?
He says, "Don't get up."
He says, "Don't get up."
It's not. It's when he's tied up. He and Drebin are tied up, and Drebin is trying to he's trying to get through the ropes binding his hands, and so he keeps rubbing them on the swing. There's just stuff falling on Meinheimer's head, but it's just the stuff that falls on it. It's like a bowling ball, and then it's some oil, and then it's some feathers, and then it's an anvil. And I don't know why that makes me laugh so much. It's just the thought of those four items being kept on top of a filing cabinet in a warehouse. Just, I love that scene.
It's true that the slapstick stuff, I think it really there's something about it that's quite primal, isn't there, that really just speaks to you. Like, you can keep watching it and it's still the first Naked Gun. I remember watching it as a kid and my face was, you know, exploding with laughter. The scene that I will never forget is when he breaks into Ludwig's apartment trying to look for evidence, and it's just a succession of the most juvenile slapstick humour. He first there's the bingo moment,
bingo,
and then
where he holds up a bingo card,
and then he finally finds the piece of evidence he's looking for, sets it on fire, the apartment sets on fire, then a self piano play. Self-playing piano just starts playing when he's trying to be, you know, quite stealthily. And then there's that fantastic bit where he climbs outside of the building. And he grabs onto these statues, and then he grabs onto a real woman's
areas.
Yes, chest.
Yeah.
And I watched the scene this morning. They actually have the ooga sound effect. That's how juvenile it is.
Doesn't he end up hanging onto a statue's listening member?
Yes. And then staggering into the room, and he, it's an amazing, amazing.
That whole sequence is just,
those are funny guys. And I remember crying with, I'm a Leslie Nielsen fanboy, and I remember going paying money to see Spy Hard, which is one of his very worst films, and that's saying something. I was with my friends Matt and Chris Johnson, and we went to the Gerrards Cross Odeon, and I've got really specific memories of Spy Hard destroying me the first 10 minutes. The rest of it was awful. But it starts with Weird Al Yankovic doing a spoof Bond song, where it's just the silhouette of Weird Al Yankovic with various things going on.
The only thing I remember from that film is Leslie Nielsen parachuting down from a plane, and he's got like a full bottle of whiskey that he just pours while he's parachuting. I thought that was
Mr. T's in it as well. It really is a terrible film, but it's got some gold. It's got some gold.
Yeah, those films are my comfort food. You know, when you're feeling a little bit down, you maybe look at the state of modern parody, modern spoofs, and you just stick them all in. They're just amazing because they're solid, solid jokes, and people actually taking time to come up with jokes, and it's not just simply, interior restaurant day, and now they improvise for 5 minutes. It's not that. And I go to Lewis Films more than I go to Monty Python or the Marx Brothers or anything like that. I just love them so much.
They're kind of like a blizzard of jokes where they're just jokes constantly hitting you. And then there are other films that have one joke that's stretched out so long that in itself just keeps you laughing, and then you stop laughing, and then you start laughing again. I always think of the scene in Spinal Tap where Derek Smalls gets trapped inside a pod on stage, and they play the entire song, but Derek Smalls is trying to get out of the pod, and then the guy with the welding torch comes along, that guy with a hammer, and he's just there, he keeps cutting back to him, and then just as he gets out, the rest of the band go back into their pods. He can't get back in, and it's about 5 minutes of screen time for one joke, but it's so good.
I had one on my list from Spinal Tap. It is a sort of often mentioned scene, but where they're trying to find the stage, and they can't find it, and that sort of drags out. And I just love this naive, like the impotent, like joy of trying to find this, like rock and roll, come on! And then they just come across the stagehand who just gave them directions, like
they meet like a janitor.
Yeah,
so
that's
like,
right.
So far off the track, it's like, it's a janitor who barely knows there's a stage anywhere in the area, and they come around the block and go back to him. That's a great scene.
Hello, Cleveland.
Yeah. Anything with Derek Smalls, who describes himself as, he describes one member of the band as fire, another one as ice, and he describes himself as lukewarm water. And the great Harry Shearer.
But you're right, the jokes that go on so long that they become unfunny,
yes,
and then go on longer so they become funny again, are absolutely amazing. And the one that's springing to mind right now, and this is probably a really bad example, is Hot Rod.
That's what I was thinking.
Where
yeah.
the scene where Andy Samberg falls down the hill. He's going on a training montage in the mountains, and he falls down this hill, and it's very Simpsons inspired, but all you see is him falling, rolling. It's about 2 minutes long, the sequence of him hitting trees and falling down the mountain and screaming in pain, and it stops being funny, and then it starts again. It's absolutely amazing.
What's the Peter Berg war film with Mark Wahlberg called? Lone Survivor. That came out after Hot Rod, and it's basically got the same scene,
yes,
where someone falls down a hill, and it's almost identical to the one in Hot Rod,
and
it's only about 5 seconds shorter.
It's played much more seriously
it's meant to be taken seriously, but yeah, Hot Rod ruined that.
Yeah.
What else? Borat, famously described by our own Dan Jolin as so funny it will burst half the blood vessels in your face.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is the most upsetting description of comedy.
You just come out of Borat with your face covered in
just blood everywhere. It's like the end of Carrie.
Yeah.
Three Amigos, the scene where Steve Martin's up on the wall. We were just watching that earlier.
Yeah.
Steve Martin's up on the wall and trying to get Chevy Chase and Martin Short to look up by basically just yelling, look up in a funny voice.
But I think you've just reminded me of a scene. It's not from a film, it's from a TV show. And we watch this all the time, you and I, which is the bike chase from the Garth Marenghi's Dark Place episode, The Apes of Wrath, which was the first thing I ever saw of Garth Marenghi. You showed it to me one day. You said, you have to see this. And I almost wept. I had to leave the room. I remember this, I had to leave the room because I was laughing so hard I thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. If you haven't seen Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, only 6 episodes were ever made, check it out. It's absolutely amazing. It's a kind of parody of terrible 1980s American TV drama, but from a British horror author. It's played by Matthew Holness, who's, it's just absolutely extraordinary, and it kind of launched the careers of Richard Ayoade and Alice Lowe and Matt Berry, and it's brilliant. And this episode,
Noel Fielding plays some kind of, I don't know what you describe him, some kind of evil ape creature.
Yeah, that's pretty much on the
pissing into water coolers,
which is exactly what he's going to do in Great British Bake Off. Weirdly enough,
he's micturating into water coolers around this hospital that's on a portal to hell.
Gavin,
and everyone who drinks it turns into an ape, and then Garth Marenghi discovers his plan and chases him on a very small bike. Yeah. And I don't know why, I can't figure out exactly why it makes me laugh so much, but yeah, I've probably seen that 20 times.
Yeah.
And it does a strange thing to me where I start overheating and like sweating. I don't know. It goes beyond laughing.
It's that
just,
sort of laughter that gets a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah. Just physically has an effect on
you
me.
You just don't feel.
It's so funny.
Yeah.
But it's the shots of Richard Ayoade in particular. They have these very terrible effects shots of him with a megaphone on a bike with motorbike sound effects.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's an amazing scene from an amazing show. So check it out. I don't think I can top Top Secret for me in terms of films, but there are other things I really, really love. Weirdly enough, the Coen Brothers is something that I always come back to as well. The Coen Brothers are amazing. I love not just jokes that go on forever and ever and ever, but sometimes the jokes are so quick that you almost miss them. I may have talked about this in the podcast before, but there's an amazing moment in Raised in Arizona where Nick Cage gets punched by Holly Hunter, and he has his facial expression after being punched by her is one of the greatest things I've ever seen, and it makes me laugh every single time. And I'm also going to mention a film that I think is much maligned in the Coen's filmography, which is Intolerable Cruelty, which is decent for the first hour or so, and then turns weirdly into this jet black dark comedy towards the in the last half hour. And there's an amazing sequence where George Clooney and his mate try to hire an assassin called Wheezy Joe, and there's just a joke that slays me every single time. They go up to this big hulking guy who's going and they go, "Hey, are you Wheezy Joe?" Figure it out, boys.
Can I say one more?
Yeah, of course you can.
There's a character in a film that's not even a comedy, but he's the character that makes me laugh the most of any movie, and he's Milton Dammers, played by Jeffrey Combs in Peter Jackson's The Frighteners, and I just cannot get in. I've probably banged on about him on the podcast
I don't
before.
Think you have, actually.
We had him on the podcast once.
We had Jeffrey Combs on the podcast.
It was really
exciting. Yeah.
That character is amazing, because on paper that's just an FBI agent comes in to investigate and chase Michael J. Fox around. That's all that character has to do. But he's so insane. Like, he's like a complete loon on every level, and everything he says is hilarious. And my favourite line of his might be, "Sheriff, you are violating my territorial bubble." You have to see it in context.
It's great. It's fantastic. There's a character on Billions series 2, season 2, happening right now. Great, great show. If you haven't watched it, check it out. There's a character in that who I think is based very strongly on Milton Dammers.
Interesting.
Yeah, really anal guy, same haircut, not necessarily the same obsession with Hitler, but, you know, maybe that'll be held back for season 3. But there you go. John, any more?
I had one more, Step Brothers.
Oh my God.
Which, I think we've talked about before, the rewatchability value of that film. You can come back to it again and again, and it somehow gets funnier. It ages like a fine wine. But
like a fine Kathleen wine mixer?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a fucking Kathleen wine mixer.
The sleepwalking scene for me is the big one. Like, it just kills me every time that one. They're just coming around. I think it's just something about their sort of demented walk and that sort of the way they get the cereal out. It's like, it's something just so like base and perfect. It speaks to me at a caveman level.
Richard Curtis revealed to us when we interviewed him very recently that Step Brothers is Paul Greengrass's favourite film.
Yeah,
it's that and the Battle of Algiers.
That's
it's my favourite
double bill.
That's something to ask Paul Greengrass next time.
Oh, all right, come round my house, we'll have a double bill. It's my Paul Greengrass impression, everybody.
Nah, Matt, I can't. I'm watching Step Brothers.
Nah, Matt.
I've gone into Frank Winston.
Stay for me, sleepwalking. Yeah, love it. Right, there we go. I've laughed so much. Meanwhile, the listeners at home are going, "Might vote for the Anfield Rap."
Oh, shit.
Which is a very good podcast, by the way. I'm not just saying it because I appeared on it 2 weeks ago. Ha ha ha, moonlighting. Right, if you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast, you can do so via a number of different ways. We are on Twitter. Yeah, that's right, Twitter as at Empire Magazine, hashtag Empire Podcast. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine. And we are, of course, on email as Madhavis Mullen discovered, much to her joy, whenever we read that question. podcast@empireonline.com is the address for that one. Right, should we talk about some movie news?
Yes.
Now,
let's do it.
Should we start with Star Wars?
Yes, of course. Massive Star Wars trailer dropped last week, and it was, of course, Star Wars Rebels Season 4.
Hey. There you go. No. This is the bit that people would be returning to.
Yes.
This is the funniest moment.
That's it. This is the gold. This is the award-winning gold.
This will burst every blood vessel in your ears.
But that was a brilliant setup.
Come on, I worked hard on that one.
You went one way.
The effort was then... clear. Yeah. The strain
the
was
prepared. Prepared remarks.
It was a lot of work to listen to it.
Amazing. You dropped the shoulder, off you went.
Oh, God.
Extraordinary. Why, what happened?
I haven't actually seen the Rebels trailer. The joke, of course, was that... And it's always best to explain your jokes. Literally, the day after we recorded the podcast last week, the first trailer for Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, mm-hmm. arrived. Too much applause and excitement.
So it begins with Rey.
Mm-hmm.
And then we move on to Parker Jr. No.
It starts very interestingly because it starts in almost the same way as The Force Awakens.
Yes.
Which started with John Boyega going... but this one starts with Daisy Ridley going...
Nailed it.
Yeah.
Nailed it.
Which I liked. A little bit of a callback.
Yeah. And it's very much a teaser. So we don't really know anything else. I mean, we don't, you know, we get reacquainted briefly with the heroes of the last movie. So we see Rey and we see that she's being trained on Ahch-To, which is the island planet where Luke Skywalker has recused himself from the fight, and he's gone off and he's having a lovely holiday, then along comes someone with a lightsaber to ruin it for him, so he's like so we see her, we see Finn again, but he's unconscious, but we're led to believe that John Boyega has not spent the entire movie recuperating.
He might have been napping.
We see a mysterious new planet called Crate with lots of new sort of skimmer fighter things that are
like
flying towards,
yeah, the red
there's red dust behind them. Some really interesting visuals in this. We see, of course, BB-8 and his big pal Poe Dameron running towards Poe's X-wing fighter, only for it to get blown up by something. What's that about? We see a brief glimpse of General Leia from behind, and of course, we get at the end of the trailer our first proper look at Luke Skywalker's silhouette.
And he says, crucially, his line at the end, which shocked everyone, it's time for the Jedi to end.
Mm.
So the Last Jedi could be instigated by Luke, theoretically.
Was that definitely Luke Skywalker speaking?
I think it was.
I'm pretty sure that was Kylo Ren.
No,
it was Luke.
Really?
It was Luke. So Luke wants the Jedi to end. This is what is being implied, at least.
Well, that's interesting, but we're kind of missing the big bombshell of the trailer, which is that there is a book, and we have talked on this podcast before about the fact there is no paper in the Star Wars universe.
Oh, yeah.
This trailer has got paper in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's got a shot of what is known as the Journal of the Wills.
Well, we think it might be the Journal of the Wills. We don't know.
I know.
You know?
I don't know.
We're flying blind here. But that's very interesting. How do people go to the toilet in the Star Wars universe is something that's long bugged me. Perhaps they use the same three shell system from Demolition Man, but who knows? I don't understand that either. But so the Journal of the Wills might play a part in this. And if Luke has spent all that time getting to know his inner self on that island, and maybe he's realized that this eternal battle of good and evil needs to stop, and people need to have their bloody heads banged together, and maybe he's become some sort of radical. Who knows? Maybe he may not be the hero that we have come to expect.
Mm. Yeah, the parallels with Empire Strikes Back are quite interesting, because obviously that was quite training heavy and quite dark, and it looks like this one's going in that direction.
Mm-hmm. I would hope that it's not simply that you can't simply overlay Empire Strikes Back in this one in the same way that you can overlay Force Awakens on New Hope. I would hope that this breaks new ground, and I have a lot of faith in Rian Johnson. I think he will deliver a very, very good film. It looks good so far, but again, it's very much a teaser. How long? 80 seconds? Something like that? Not a lot to go on at this point in time. Fingers crossed. Happy.
Yes, and it debuted at Star Wars Celebration last weekend, which James Dyer was at.
Oh, yeah.
You can read all about in a forthcoming issue of Empire magazine.
Can we?
Sneaky plug. Yes, we can.
Can we?
Yeah, we can.
Oh, that's nice. There we go. Everyone's happy. What else is happening this week in the world of movie news? Nicholas.
Okay, so Will Smith is in talks to play the genie in Guy Ritchie's Aladdin movie, which is such a strange sentence. I mean, I've got questions about almost every word in that.
I mean, did you see that tweet that was going around with Guy Ritchie? It just said, Guy Ritchie directs Aladdin, and it was the picture of Alan Partridge with his dictaphone. You know, just...
It's a bit monkey tennis, isn't it? But you know, it could be great. I kind of have doubts, personal doubts, about whether Guy Ritchie is the right guy to do a live action remake of Disney's Aladdin. But you never know, do you? You never know. I feel quite good about that casting, though. I think Will Smith is, if you're gonna have a movie star playing a genie, the genie, why not Will Smith?
Yeah, because you need someone who's got a lot of charisma. You need someone who can improvise. You need someone who's funny. You need someone who's going to somehow match up to the force of nature that was Robin Williams in the original. How do you do that? It's a very short list, I would say.
I mean, you kind of almost don't want to... He's not going to try and ape Robin Williams' sort of vocal acrobatics and impressions and voices. You can't. You just can't. It's an impossible task. So you would hope that they put a bit of a new spin on it, that it's not just this sort of endless sea of different characters coming out of the genie.
Well, yeah, I don't think there are very few people like Robin Williams who you can just go, right, off you go.
Yeah.
And
Jim Carrey.
Yeah, Jim Carrey, you know, who else could possibly be on some sort of improvisational plane? Eddie Murphy, Rob Brydon. Will Ferrell. Yeah, people like that. Ryan Reynolds, who is amazingly funny, but I think Will Smith's, this is a good choice.
He hasn't been in the kind of full comedy mode for a really long time. Suicide Squad, obviously, he was very serious in that. Concussion, Focus was a bit lighter, but he wasn't really going for full comedy. So it's been all the way back to like Men in Black 3, which was 2012, and arguably that wasn't very funny. So this feels like a kind of throwback to 90s Will Smith.
Yeah,
I hope.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting was he was in talks, or maybe he still is in talks, to star in Tim Burton's Dumbo.
I don't think so. I think that apparently the same stories are saying that he's not involved in that.
He's not involved.
So I think he probably had a meeting about that and it turned into a meeting about this, maybe.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you don't like Dumbo? Well, we have Aladdin.
You
don't
can
like
play
Aladdin?
Bambi?
Yeah. There's the broomstick and Fantasio. You think it'd be great for that, Will. We have no shortage of movies.
Yeah.
It's intriguing. Can Guy Ritchie pull it off? We shall see.
How live action is this film going to be? Do we know? Are we actually going to see Will Smith, or are we going to see some sort of CGI?
Well, we don't know that yet. I assume it's going to be a CG genie. A CG genie. We all jumped on that. And it all felt bad about it immediately afterwards.
Yeah. That would not be one of my three wishes, to like pull that gag off. It wouldn't be, you know. What is, you know, and your
it was one of mine. It was,
yeah,
one.
Really?
I've only got one left. My Dumbledore pun last week was one of the other ones. So moving on. I don't know how interested you guys were in the story, but I'm really excited about this. Lock and Key, which is a Joe Hill graphic novel, comic book, call it what you will, series, which is amazing. I read it last year and it kind of blew me away. And it's getting turned into a Hulu live action TV series. The pilot's going to be directed by Scott Derrickson of Doctor Strange. Mm-hmm. It's going to be produced by Carlton Cuse. And if you don't know the story, it's set in New England in this creepy mansion, and a family move in and they find these keys, and they're kind of magical keys that can do all kinds of things. One of them, you can open someone's head and mess around with their memories. And there's a demon who is trying to open this door in an underground cave and unleash the forces of evil. And it's really good. I mean, it's going to be a really tricky one to pull off in live action. Because it's pretty out there and pretty trippy.
Yeah.
Roberto Orsi and Alex Kurtzman tried to do it, and they did it. They shot a pilot, I think, about 5 years ago, and that nothing happened there. But I'm excited by this.
Okay, I actually like Joe Hill a lot, but I haven't read that. I should check it out.
I recommend it.
There we go. So Hulu,
sounds good.
Lock and Key. Yeah, all on board. Sounds good to me. You've sold me.
Earlier this week, we had news that James Gunn will be directing Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, which is exciting news. Yes. Who could have thought that the director of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1, would return? But no, I think this is exciting news. This is good news. They sort of did what they did last time, where they essentially announced the sequel before the next film has arrived, which is a sort of real vote of confidence. You know, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 premiered this week, I think, or last week. It's been getting loads of positive buzz on Twitter. So Marvel are obviously quite confident about the future of this franchise and where it's going to go. These characters are going to be in Infinity War, obviously. And yeah, it makes sense, I guess, that James Gunn should shepherd them through to the threequel.
It's interesting because it suggests that Star-Lord is going to come to Earth in Infinity War, and then instead of staying home, he's going to bugger off again.
Well, it's funny. I saw somewhere that there's been little morsels about what we can expect from Infinity War. I think Zoe Saldana was interviewed, and she seemed to imply that the fight will come to space. So rather than the Guardians go to Earth, the Avengers might go to space. I mean, that's where Thanos lives, you know. So they might go visit his space toilet.
We don't know maybe. We don't know how much they're going to be in those films.
It's hard to say, isn't it?
I may or may not have spoken to Chris Pratt pretty recently, and he may or may not have said that he has finished shooting on Infinity War already. So,
I mean, they have like 3,500 characters to fit in over a 6-hour running time.
Nobody's finished in these movies. Nobody's finished. I think even after 6 months after it'll be released, people will be called back for additional shooting. It's one of these. This is kind of a surprise because he'll be the James Gunn would be the first director to see a trilogy all the way through in the MCU. It obviously shows a lot of confidence in Guardians 2, the same way that they announced Guardians 2 just before Guardians 1 came out. So fingers crossed, none of us have seen Guardians 2 yet, but fingers crossed that it's as good as the first one or as close to the first one. But as for Infinity War, I hadn't thought about them going to space. That'd be interesting.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah, take that Fast and Furious 10 that everyone thinks is going to end up in space because that's the only way it can go. Except if it goes inwards, the core of the Earth.
That's right.
Yeah, Dom Toretto, the only person who can withstand the heat at the core of planet Earth.
He's got enough Nos to keep him cool down there, the Earth's core.
Now I'm dreaming up a Fast and Furious Guardians crossover with Vin Diesel meeting Groot.
Whoa.
I am Groot.
They'd be
I am
family.
Dom. We I, are family.
Groot just says, I'm Groot, and Vin Diesel just says, we are family. And they just say that to each other for 2 hours.
And it still makes $1 billion. Should we talk about the fact that Fast and Furious 8 has set the record, which I don't expect it to hold for very much longer, but certainly not by the end of the year, for the biggest opening weekend of all time. By that I mean worldwide. Because it actually underperformed Fast 7 or Furious 7, if you're an American viewer, listener, by some considerable distance in the States. It opened to less than 100 million in the States, which is not a flop by any stretch of the imagination. It is very, very, very good indeed. But that was lent considerable ballast by the rest of the world. So $520 million opening weekend.
I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it? $500 million in a couple of days.
Wow. Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah.
I mean, it
is partly down to, as you say, the sort of quirk of release dates. A lot of movies tend to stagger international releasing. And this, I think they went full blast, you know, as in true Fast and Furious style, they went full on and released pretty much everywhere on the same day, which probably helped.
Also, they made it mandatory you had to go and see it. That was an interesting development, but I went along with it. It's fine. We actually did pay to see it this week, didn't we, Nick?
We did. Yeah. We did. I'm still recovering. I feel shell-shocked. Yeah, I should have picked the shell up and thrown it at a Russian separatist. I do wish we were doing a spoiler special for that film. There is so much to talk about.
It's a film you really can deconstruct just for hours and hours. Just if you start to pick apart the sort of logic or physics of it, then you just get lost in a wormhole.
I'm no scientist, but I think if you started to pick apart the physics of the Fast and Furious franchise, I don't know, you'd be here all year. But the logic of it is really interesting, and Dom's master plan in particular is keeping me awake at night. How did he know what he knew, when he knew it, and how did he communicate that to other people? I don't want to get into too much because I'm sure there are some people out there who haven't seen it. But
judging by the gross, only about two of them, and they both live in a submarine in Greenland or Russia.
It's hard to, or green screen then. Green screen land, I think, is where
they never had a title card, I don't think. I'm probably getting this wrong, but they had a title card for New York, which is the most obvious place. But they didn't have one for the third act of the movie.
Oh, they did.
They did have one. Yeah, all right, sorry about
they
that.
They did, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah, the Fast and Furious franchise is nothing if not about details.
Okay. Yeah, clearly.
It's about the micro, not the macro. Where would we? Yes, anyway, so it's done incredibly well, $520 million worldwide, and it's almost certain now to break a billion, and yeah, it's a big noise.
We live in strange times.
We live in strange times. Should we talk about another franchise that's hit $1 billion over the last few years, which is James Bond?
James Bond, $1 billion.
He's done very well for himself, hasn't he, this James Bond? Sony's deal with Eon and with MGM expired as a Spectre. And so currently, according to the New York Times, there is a five-way studio tug-of-war to take over the Bond franchise. But they're only being offered a one-film deal, which is very interesting. And the five studios are Sony, Fox, Universal, Megan Ellison's Annapurna, which is the wild card here. Nobody, you know, she's somebody who's been investing in independent productions and seems to be going bigger with this one. And
Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers. So, interestingly, Paramount not going for this. They have, of course, their own spy franchise in Mission Impossible. And really interestingly, Disney aren't going for it, presumably because they own everything else.
Yes.
They're just giving other people a chance.
Yeah, go on. You can have Bond. It's fine.
He could have joined the Avengers. That's a shame.
So Disney are back in the game.
The really interesting, well, for me, the interesting detail was Sony made their, they did a video presentation to try and win over, you know, the people who own the rights, and they reconstructed a set from Dr. No to do their presentation, which is an amazing touch. I think everyone should have had to have done that. Like, do it from a hollowed out volcano base. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Presumably they were stroking a white caps in the video.
I hope there were lasers involved.
Yeah. But it's all very intriguing. And this week, so it seems like, you know, we're heading together. I think we're heading for that point where I would imagine, this is just a complete guess, that they will announce, they'll go with someone, and then they'll probably announce Bond 25 as a package deal. Whenever that happens, they'll announce the director, they'll announce who's going to be Bond. Is it going to be Daniel Craig again? Is it going to be someone else? Sam Mendes, in an interview this week, apparently said that it's not going to be what you expect, which is different. We were, because lots of people expect different things. So some people are expecting it to be Daniel Craig, some people are expecting it to be Tom Hiddleston, some people are saying maybe Idris Elba might be back in the ring, Dan Stevens, who seems to be Bond in waiting. I don't know, it's there's lots of stuff going on, so you know. But very intrigued, very intrigued.
Captain Marvel has a pair of directors. They are Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, the directors of Mississippi Grind, which I know you're a big fan of.
Love that film. Great film. And of course, Half Nelson as well.
Staying on a Marvel vibe, Spider-Man has been confirmed as being in Avengers 4.
Not a shock, but it's
not a shock, is it?
It's certainly interesting. And of course, Kevin Feige this week, I think, sat down with some American press in America at Marvel HQ, and he gave some tidbits for the future of Marvel, and that was one of them. But he also confirmed that the Spider-Man spin-offs that are happening at Sony, so that, you know, they're really really trying to milk it now with you know, a Black Cat and Silver Sable spin-off and the Venom spin-off, that they are nothing to do with Marvel. Marvel have no input into those movies. They only deal directly with things that involve the web-slinger himself. So that doesn't make me feel any better about those movies.
Yeah.
I have to say. But hey-ho, we shall see. We shall see what happens in the future. Anything else, John, and your big movie news clock? Anything before we move on?
The only thing I have is Thor Ragnarok. We had a little bit of minor news of staying in Marvel. Taika Waititi has announced that he will be starring in a small role. He's going to be playing an 8-foot-tall alien called Korg, who's made entirely out of rocks. It's he lives on the planet Sakaar, which is the planet that Thor is banished from. It's the gladiatorial planet that Jeff Goldblum lives on. He's apparently, according to Waititi, he's huge and heavy, but he has a very light soul. This is what he said. Obviously, being made of rocks, we would have gotten someone like The Rock to play him, but there wasn't enough chicken or salmon in Australia to sustain both him and Chris Hemsworth. So we got the next best thing, which is this super hot young character actor named Taika Waititi, who I've personally come to love. So that's a nice thing to look forward to, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should mention before we move on as well that this week we saw the first footage from Kingsman: The Golden Circle in a very unusual way. I really like the way they did this, actually. It's not a trailer per se. It is a 15-second blipfert, is what I believe these things are now being called officially. And it's a series of images from the movie running past your eyes faster than you can possibly see it. So the idea is that you will have to freeze frame it to check out each insane image from that movie, which I'm very excited about. So yeah, there you go. Lots of madness coming our way. Intriguing. Okay, so that's it for the movie news, but let's talk about ourselves for a little bit here, because it is the end of the month, which means it's New Empire time.
Hooray!
Here we are. So here we are. The new issue of Empire magazine is on sale right now, and it is an absolute belter. On the cover this month, it's Alien Covenant. Oh my word, yes. And I've got a lovely picture of Danny McBride on the front. No, that's an alien. And it's an amazing embossed cover with the alien from Ridley Scott's Alien Covenant, and inside Helen O'Hara.
The alien is a nightmare to shoot, by the way. If you're wondering,
just keeps moving around.
If you're considering such a diva. Doing a photography session with a xenomorph, honestly, don't do it. He's a complete dick.
How many photographers did we go through?
He ate 9 of them. And then he sort of somehow burst out of the 10th.
Yeah. Which is actually the shot we got. It's him going, "Hey!" Yeah, alien selfies are not easy to get. So Helen O'Hara, who's currently running around Nepal at the moment, and I haven't heard from her in a couple of days. I'm getting a little worried, but she should be back next week. She's doing that amazing running thing she signed up for. She was on set in Australia, and she talked to everybody, Ridley Scott, Michael Fassbender, Catherine Waterston, Danny McBride, the alien itself, all sorts of things. So it's a really, really great feature, so check it out. And if you don't like alien movies, if you don't like Ridley Scott, then honestly, what are you doing? But there's other stuff in the magazine as well. We were on set of Guy Ritchie's King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. We also talked to Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn, who are teaming up ahead of Snatched. We have a feature on Pirates of the Caribbean, Salazar's Revenge. Maybe we'll find out why it's called Salazar's Revenge over here, not Dead Men Tell No Tales, which is a much better title. We were also talking to almost everybody involved with Feep. The brilliant Feep, which is now back on our screens, or coming back on our screens very, very soon, and asking the question, how can you do political satire post Donald Trump? And the Empire interview this month is Noomi Rapace, who is in a film called
Unlocked,
and also in Alien Covenant, maybe. In the news section, we have looks at Spider-Man Homecoming, Paddy Considine's Journeyman, Fargo Season 3, Ray Winston is a pint of milk. We review all the films around this month as well, and the review section is also very, very good this month. Lots of great things inside the issue. Gareth Edwards talking about Rogue One. Steve Pemberton and Reese Shearsmith taking us through all their favourite looks from Inside Number 9 over the years. Don Coscarelli on Phantasm. And Manchester by the Sea is one of my favourite things. We have also John Spates, the screenwriter of Passengers. I interviewed him and we talked in depth about the film's successes and failures, and maybe the bits that people felt the film didn't tackle that well ethically and morally. And he mounts a robust defence, shall we say. And what else is in there? Oh yes, Kenneth Lonergan. I sat down with Kenneth Lonergan and we talked through that scene from Manchester by the Sea. You know the one I'm talking about. We talked about that. Big deep dive as well. So
the one with the seagull.
The one with the seagull. Steven Seagull. That's the one. So very, very exciting issue. On sale right now. £4.70. All good and evil news agents. Highly to one of those immediately. Right. Should we have a guest?
Yes.
Let's have a guest. Very, very exciting to see that National Geographic are moving into scripted drama. And they're doing so with a show called Genius, which may, over various seasons, tell the story of particular geniuses. And the one they're starting off with, well, it's a bit of a no-brainer, isn't it? Which is also a working title for the show. Albert Einstein, who I believe was a smart dude. Who better to play him than the great Jeffrey Rush? Oscar winner, of course, for Shine, nominated countless other times as well, and a really, really great guy as well. He came into London about 2 weeks ago. I sat down with him in a hotel room, and we had a good old chat about all sorts of things. John, you've heard this more recently than I have. What did we talk about?
Einstein.
And the nature of genius, didn't we?
Genius.
Yep.
And Mystery Men.
Did you leave that in?
Yes.
The farting stuff?
Yes. Okay. I thought that was very interesting.
There we go. So there we go. We run the gamut.
Einstein to farting.
Yeah.
In
60 seconds.
I think young Einstein might have beaten us too, though.
We talked about that. We talked about Yahoo Sirius. We talked about all sorts of stuff.
Amazing.
There you go. Jeffrey Rush, do enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the great Jeffrey Rush. How are you, sir?
Thank you very much.
Very good, very good. Glad to hear it. Are you not jet-lagged? Are you okay?
I flew in from Melbourne yesterday.
Okay.
So I'm not on an autopilot. But it's just always strange when you're 10 hours out of whack.
Yeah, absolutely. So what time is it for you now? What are you?
It would be 1 in the morning.
Okay, all right.
It's not bad.
That's fine, that's fine. Yeah, you a night owl? Do you usually stay up late?
It varies. Really varies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll see how we go. And so this is obviously wanted to talk about Genius, mm-hmm. in which you become one of the few people. This is actually surprising that not many people have played Albert Einstein.
I looked into that.
Yeah.
Because my colleague Fred Skepsey, mm-hmm. a great Australian director, and I worked with him about 4 or 5 years ago on a Patrick White adaptation.
Yes.
Of a novel, and he had done a sort of not screwball comedy. It was called IQ.
Oh, yes, of course.
With
Walter Matthau.
Walter Matthau.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was about Einstein in his latter years at Princeton. And it was like, by memory, there was a teen romance where Einstein's cousin or something was wanting to get the girl. And
Tim Robbins,
if I recall. She was very attracted to him. It was... I can't think of the woman who was in it.
I think it was Meg Ryan.
It was Meg Ryan, of course. Yeah, so that's one of the few.
Yeah.
And then within the series, we have this, when I read these episodes towards the end, I think it's like about episode 9, Einstein's then housekeeper keeps pestering him about MGM and the screenplay. Have you read it yet?
Okay, okay.
Because they're doing this story called The Beginning of the End. Mm-hmm. And it's about the development of the atomic bomb.
Okay.
And Einstein still remains a pacifist to his dying days. But, you know, in the default position, gets caught up pretty much with the blame for the atomic bomb because Time magazine put his face with a mushroom cloud and E equals MC squared. And for him, and dramatically within the story, it's not a bad kind of narrative moment because he was always a pacifist. He grew up despising German militarism and so forth. Handed in his German passport and said, mm-hmm. I want to be a citizen of the world. He was a very open thinker, you know. But anyway, in the story, you then see this is in the late 40s, I think. So he was pretty much in his late 60s. You see screen tests, you know, with the wax pencil and the kind of whatever, and three Einsteins come up. And I loved the idea of that. And I met these guys, the three guys that were going to do it. Well, I met them at lunch once in the catering tent.
You know? Right.
And they looked perfectly cast because I said, I'd love to, just even reading the text is like, we are going to save the world. You know what I mean? It was fairly early on in the shoot. And I thought, I'm really glad that we're trying to find a way of having these characters think and speak in their native language, Germany, German.
Yes.
But it's English language,
yes,
you know,
course.
Because it's that actorial dilemma, and I've spoken to quite a number of actors. You don't want to sound like a native German speaker where English is their second language. It's quite a different thing.
Yes.
So you've got to find cadence and rhythm and certain sounds so that it doesn't feel like, you know, it's Clouseau in French in English.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's the thing. And then eventually I go to see it, and I did get to see the extracts of the guy who played Einstein in The Beginning of the End. And it's not what I'd call a great performance. and I did find out that he was a German actor, I believe.
Uh-huh.
But to me, it sounded like he was an Irish character actor on the MGM lot.
Yeah.
Doing a German accent that had a lot of Irish in it.
Well, you have to play to the cheap seats, I guess.
It's pretty funny. Yeah, but apart from that, I think Andy Serkis did a film about Eddington and Einstein,
yes.
which was more about the one chapter in his life where the British mathematician or physicist Eddington was the one that did a lot of... He helped him enormously when they were analyzing the refraction of the eclipse off Mercury. That was the way they could show that gravitational forces of the sun could bend light. And that pretty much sealed Einstein's celebration of his achievement, that the ripple effect from that was that, you know, the theory of relativity has been kind of, or one aspect of it has been absolutely empirically verified.
Absolutely. You know? So that's two.
So, yeah, and I think that's about it. I'm waiting for Einstein the musical. That I'm sure that's going to happen, you know.
Well, there is Yahoo Sirius as Young Einstein.
Well, no, of course. Yahoo Sirius, Young Einstein. Which, you know, and it's time, and that must be now 30 years ago, mid-80s.
It feels like it, yeah. Yeah, it would be.
It was a very rock and roll, Antipodean take on the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, I didn't know Yahoo well. I ran into him occasionally because this was in my theater days, not being in the world of film and everything.
Mm.
But I quite liked the audacity of what if he'd been from Tasmania. It's a Python sketch, really, you know.
Absolutely. What if you could play a bitching guitar solo?
Yeah, that's
that sort
right.
Of thing. Absolutely.
Yes, the hair was, I think, something short-circuiting from an amp, and that made it go into the recognizable halo, and he thought, I look good like that.
Precisely. Know? None of which, I imagine, you took when you were when you were planning out your version.
No, when I was looking at it, I was looking at things, you know, the iconography of him. It's a little bit like there used to be a massive painting on one of the buildings in L.A., and it was an Apple ad, I think. Think Different. They had a logo. And it was John and Yoko, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I thought, I grew up with John Lennon. His writing, his poetry, his time with the Beatles, his solo album, invaded my life from young teenage to into my 30s.
Interesting.
You know? And I thought, you know, a 13-year-old looking at that building now would go, I think that might be John. He's one of the Beatles. I'm not sure which one. You know what I mean? There'd be that vagueness. And so it's the same with Einstein. I mean, I was 4 when he died.
Yeah.
So everything I know about him has been filtered down through a dalliance that I had with physics when I was at high school up until year 12. I was doing chemistry, applied maths. Like, I had the wrong vocational guidance officer because I had fantasies from about year 8 in, you know, junior school that I would be an astronomer.
Oh, really?
Because I'd become obsessed by the Mercury space program when I was about 10.
Okay.
Whenever Alan Shepard went into space and then when John Glenn orbited.
Yes.
Then the Gemini program, the Apollo program. This was all happening right through to the Challenger and the shuttles and the space station. I always read about that stuff.
Okay.
You know, so I'm Brian Cox's and Neil deGrasse Tyson's biggest fan because as a lay cosmologist, these guys are broadening those kind of horizons
in a very
populist way, which is fantastic. So my dreams of being an astronomer got crushed. And also in about year 11 is when we as students at my very suburban state high school, we took over the running of our school drama club. And then, of course, I went to university and it was a very active time politically and theatrically on campus. And then I went in that direction.
Okay.
But I still try and keep up with the complexities of quantum physics. but what I want to say to your listeners is, hopefully they will watch this series, because it's, you know, the logo is, it's the the mind behind the man, mm-hmm. or the man behind the mind, I think is the more correct reading of it.
Yes.
It's not a National Geographic documentary. It is a scripted drama series, and mm-hmm. it looks at this central protagonist who, if you almost treat him as a fictional character, he's somebody that moves through an epoch of time.
Yeah.
That's the golden age of Prussian scientific, well, late 19th century industrial and scientific development, whether it's the kinematograph or the automobile or X-rays or the Curies breaking down radio. There was electromagnetism. There was stuff going on.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
And then they had the dilemma of confronting two major world wars where science and someone like Einstein in particular, he would have been in his mid-30s by then. The First World War, he was a staunch pacifist and anti-German militarist. He found the outcome of the Great War was really a great moral dilemma for him because, let's say, one of his close colleagues, Fritz Haber, mm-hmm. would be given the Nobel Prize for... as a chemist, he found a way of extracting nitrogen from the air to make fertilizer because the powers that be in Germany at that time said, we're going to run out of harvests in the next 3 or 4 years and our population will perish. And he, through the goodness of science, salvaged a country's well-being by keeping our agriculture alive. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Fritz Haber also invented chlorine gas, which kind of wiped out a hell of a lot of people in the First World War.
Wow.
And he and Einstein came to, you know, argumentative blows over science being used for violence rather than humankind's benefit, you know. And then, of course, right through to the bomb. So, you know, in some ways, I looked at the role... I sort of fictionalized the story in my mind and said, okay, well, I did King Lear last year, and I thought, I don't want to read books about King Lear. I read a little about the history of the play and everything. I have to go by what story is being told, who are the other characters, what are the forces he's up against. This character is the central protagonist, and he confronts the world, himself, mm-hmm. the metaphoric heath, the mm-hmm. storm, mm-hmm. the domestic strife, you know what I mean?
Mm, yeah.
And Einstein in this particular series is writ large on his domestic level and his scientific level and his flaws as well as his great generosity as a humanist and pacifist and all of those elements that make him such an interesting contradictory character. They're all in play, which is a great way of saying he's not just the guy that stuck his tongue out at the paparazzi, even though I think we get that moment in there somewhere. It might even just be in a newspaper, and I think J. Edgar Hoover looks at it and takes it very personally because he was, you know, really witch-hunting Einstein as a communist, which he wasn't. I mean, he had socialist philosophical beliefs, but he said there's no way I would subject myself to being run by the state. That means I would lose my individuality, which is crucial to every human being, you know.
Just one last thing I wanted to ask you, Jeffrey, before I let you go, is one of your performances I really enjoy is Casanova Frankenstein in Mystery Men.
Thank you.
Now, I'm sure you weren't expected to hear that. And there were
some bad reviews for that.
There were some bad reviews, but that film has aged has aged well, I think. There is one scene in particular I've always wanted to ask you about, and it's a scene where Paul Rubens, how can I put this delicately, farts in your face. And I remember being struck by that. I even wrote a review of it going, the former P.B. Herman runs down a window and lets go in newly minted Oscar winner's face. And I've always wanted to know what was going through your mind as you filmed that sequence.
Disdain for these wannabe suburban superheroes. I thought it was such, to me, that sense of comedy, I suppose because of Barry Humphreys, the idea of taking from Flaming Carrot, the idea of comic book superheroes who had really no powers.
Yes.
They were average Joes or Joe S's, from the suburbs. Yes. One was good with a shovel. One had terrible wind. The other one had anger.
Yes.
You know, and I thought, this is genius.
Yeah.
This is something that no one's ever seen before. Unfortunately, the film, because there were seven amazing comedians playing that gang, the film's rough cut lended up to be something like 3 hours 20. So, unfortunately, poor old Casanova Frankenstein hit the cutting room floor.
Oh, no.
Because the scenes I had with my psychiatrist girlfriend, we were like the high comedy. I ended up dancing her. She catches me in bed with the role that Claire Forlani played, the young ingenue.
Interesting.
And I go, this is not what it looks like. And she thinks, it looks exactly what it looks like. And I charmed her and I waltzed her like it was a William Powell, Carol Lombard scene, and threw her off the balcony over a cliff. And I love the idea that the low comedy of the suburban humor and then this was all intercut, but it didn't kind of turn
that's
like.
That's a shame. That's a
but
shame.
It's... I have noted through some, just through fan mails, people occasionally say that film rocked, you know, and people come up to me and, you know, you try and pick the demographic. You can see them, they're going to come up and ask for a selfie or an autograph.
Yeah.
And you go, Banger Sisters fan or, you know what I mean? You try and you play this crazy game with yourself. And there are people who just come up and go, I am Ballerina Man. And I go, that's really great. You're quoting a line from a film that everyone seemed to loathe.
Yeah, absolutely. Disco is not dead. Disco means life.
Yes.
But there we go. Fantastic.
Thanks so much.
Jeffrey Rush, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Jeffrey Rush there. And Genius begins on the National Geographic Channel over here on Sunday. That's the 23rd of April, Sunday. Okay, time now for this week's reviews. Let's start off with Their Finest, which is a World War II, how would you describe it? Dramedy? Comedy drama with Gemma Arterton, who was last week's guest.
Yeah,
and
the way I described it to Gemma Arterton or asked if she would agree was a wartime romantic comedy feminist behind the scenes drama, because it's unpigeonholable a little
bit.
Isn't
she in it? Why were you describing it to her? She forgotten.
I was pitching it to her just to see.
Right.
So this is... As Ian Freer in the Empire Review describes it, it's a little bit like a sort of British Hail Caesar set in the 1940s Ealing Studios sort of vibe. So Gemma Arterton plays a female screenwriter in World War II who's sort of recruited to write a propaganda film for the government. She's essentially recruited to write slop, as they call it, which is dialogue for women. The dialogue at the time is mostly written by men who don't really understand the female experience. But as you know, World War II sets in and all the men go to war, women have to step up. So Gemma Arterton's character is recruited to write a film about two women who steal their father's boats and use it in the Dunkirk rescue. So it's a really interesting story. And along the way, she meets a co-writer played by Sam Claflin from The Hunger Games. And then she's also tasked with dealing with a very sort of smug and arrogant actor played by Bill Nighy, who is in a very Bill Nighy role. It's extremely... It's the sort of role you can't think of anyone else except Bill Nighy to play. And it's a very light, it's a very broad crowd pleaser, I suppose you could call it. It's slightly predictable in the ways it goes. I feel like the romance is perhaps a little bit obvious, you could say. But
between Gemma Arterton and Bill Nighy,
And Sam Claflin.
And Sam Claflin.
Not
all three of them.
Not Bill Nighy. No.
Well.
No.
Oh, okay. So between Gemma Arterton and Sam Claflin.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
But what it does do really interestingly, unlike a lot of crowd pleasers, is it doesn't really talk down to the audience. There's a lot of interesting ideas being played upon here, most obviously with the war and with bureaucracy and the power of cinema to bring people out to boost morale. I mean, that's what 30 million people were going to see films in Britain at the time when there was 40 million people as a population. So it's a huge communication tool, and it's a huge way of lifting people's spirits at a really sort of downbeat time. And it really gets under the skin of the business of making films. There's a lot of lovely behind-the-scenes moments and things that I think filmmakers might recognise. But this also talks a lot about the role of women. You know, the 1940s was a time when women sort of came to the fore a bit. Mm. Their roles changed because the men were away at war, so suddenly there are women doing the jobs of men. And it, so it's sort of quietly feminist film. There's little moments of sexism. There's a point where Richard E. Grant plays a government official and he says, well, obviously you can't be paid as much as the chaps, you know, and it's a little throwaway line, but it's very telling. And there's this really interesting, the way Gemma Arterton's character responds to this sexism. That's quite interesting that, you know, you can make a feminist film and it's not nakedly feminist. You know, it doesn't sort of shove this agenda down your throat, but it does present these arguments in a really sort of organic and natural way. And through her character, you do see the inequalities and see and she as a character also fights for her own space in a very natural way. Yes. And I think that's really impressive. And also it's very funny. It's very likable. A lot of that comes from Bill Nighy. You know, he does steal the show a lot of the time. And there are times when you think he's on autopilot, but he the way he can just raise a little eyebrow and make you laugh, there's something very impressive about that. I mean, he's shown us before how good he is at that sort of thing.
Fantastic.
So this could be a double bill with Dunkirk later in the year.
Yeah. But no, it's an extremely likable film, and it has a lot to say, which I think is rare for this sort of film sometimes.
We're talking about Fast and Furious 8 came out last week. We're not watching it. It has a lot to say about family.
Family, yes.
Yeah, and family.
Nitrous oxide.
Nitrous oxide. Yeah, and nothing else, really.
They're fastest.
They're fastest. They're furiousest. 4 stars in for Alona Scherfig's Their Finest. A movie I suspect has actually something in common with Warren Beatty's Rules Don't Apply, which is the next film we're going to be talking about. Both are, you know, informed by love of cinema.
Yes. Yeah. This is another sort of interesting, sort of, I guess you could call it, romantic comedy set against the backdrop of behind the scenes cinema, but this is Hollywood. This is more 1960s or late 50s, early 60s, and it's a strange film, this, because this is something that Warren Beatty's been talking about making for what, 40 years now. I think he's had it gestating in some form or another for since the 1960s, because it is about Howard Hughes, who is this extraordinary historical character. He's a businessman, he's an aviator, and he is a film producer, but this is not a Howard Hughes biopic. This is not a film about Howard Hughes. Howard Hughes sort of skulks in the background, quite literally. I mean, you sort of, the first time you see him, he's just hiding in the shadows. I mean, he's a very reclusive man. He's you know, he hates human or physical contact, really. So a lot of the scenes, he is just like hiding behind a curtain, or he's just in a room with all the lights off. But the focus isn't really on him. The focus is on two young people. There's Frank Forbes, who is one of his drivers. He has drivers who drive around his actresses around Hollywood, played by Alden Ehrenreich. And then there's Marla Mabry, played by Lily Collins, who is one of his upcoming young starlets who wants to be big in Hollywood. Both of these characters are strictly religious, and both of them have a sort of burgeoning romance for each other, but their religion gets in the way of this a little bit, and also Howard Hughes gets in the way of this a little bit, as he is wont to do. And so it's an interesting film. For something that's been gestating for so long, it doesn't quite feel like it's focused enough. There is a sort of screwball energy to it. There is, you know, the fact that Howard Hughes is so eccentric means there's an element of farce to it.
Are there wacky mix-ups involving jars of urine?
There's no jars of urine, but he does mine some of the more the wilder moments of Howard Hughes' life. I think the fact that it is a little unfocused means it's not always as successful as it could be a lot of the time. But there is some really interesting stuff there, and I think a lot of people have been reading some sort of autobiographical element to it that Warren Beatty sees a little bit of himself in Howard Hughes. I mean, he is now considered sort of Hollywood legend. And so there's a sort of there is a kind of mysterious and slightly otherworldly quality to Howard Hughes.
Well, I think it's the fact that, you know, if you were to look at it from an autobiographical standpoint, you could say that it's the beginning and the end of Warren Beatty's career, in
right?
A way. In that the Alden Ehrenreich character Frank is essentially a young Warren Beatty, but without the desire to act. He's a young religious guy, because Warren Beatty was mm-hmm. religious, and who came to L.A. and found that there was. There were things that that were previously on the forbidden menu to him that he quite liked, and then of course you could look at the Howard Hughes, the reclusive character, who has this reputation as being this quite strange, idiosyncratic guy, which you know, if you listen to the Warren Beatty interview, he is not that. He has not lived his life like a recluse. He's been raising kids for the last 18 years or so. But I think it's a bit glib to read it in. It's a bit pat to try and read it into it a little bit. The issue I have with this movie, and I think this movie is very interesting, is that it's two movies in one, and one movie is very, very good. The other one is not that great. Isn't as compelling as I would want it to be. And that's the central love story between Alden Ehrenreich's Frank and Lily Collins' Marla, which they're fine and they look great and they have nice chemistry together, but it doesn't quite pop for me the way that it perhaps should have done. Meanwhile, all the interesting stuff's happening with Howard Hughes, which is a very, very good performance from Warren Beatty, and there's some really interesting print the legend stuff going on that, you know, about, you know, how just weird and idiosyncratic and he was, and he was a man who was aware that he was perhaps losing his grip on his sanity a little bit, and was trying desperately to dig himself in and surround himself with yes people on all sides. Some decent performances as well. It's got an interesting cast.
Amazing cast.
I mean, people just turn up in this movie every 5 minutes. You're going, what, another one?
Alec Baldwin just pops in for five minutes.
The Venn diagram of the aviator and the rules don't apply has Alec Baldwin right slap bang in the middle. I wish he'd played the same character in both, but he doesn't. And then you have Steve Coogan turns up towards the end for a is that Steve Coogan cameo? And yes, it is. Candice Bergen's in the film. Matthew Broderick's very good in the film.
Annette Bening, obviously.
Paul Sorvino, who I haven't seen in a film for years, is in this movie and gets nothing to do. I get the impression there's a much, much longer cut of this film, and that's probably about three and a half hours. We let both stories breathe, and that would probably be a lot better, but maybe commercial pressures, who knows.
I felt like I was just confused that he felt he needed the romantic sort of young person's story at all. I think Howard Hughes is such a fascinating character and has so many strange sort of nooks and crannies of his life that, you know, a whole film about him, I would be fascinated to watch in itself. I don't think you need that extra level.
Did I tackle it with him? I don't know. If we did, I don't think he answered it in that directly. I agree with you. I'm certainly, again, we're talking about, you know, commercial pressures. Warren Beatty's been away as a director for a long, long time. Bullworth's last movie didn't do that well either. And maybe you come back and you think, well, I'm 80 years old and I've been away for a while, and yes, I'm Warren Beatty, but does that mean people will come and sit and see a film that I'm in? Ah, but what if I center it around these two young bucks? Maybe then it'll be a hit, which of course it
is. Howard Hughes is just such a fascinating character. I haven't seen Rules Don't Apply, but I do wish it had been about him. Mm. There are a bunch of films where Howard Hughes is kind of a supporting character, but he's so colourful, and I just remembered he's in The Rocketeer, played by Terry O'Quinn from Lost.
Oh, yes, of course.
The Rocketeer is awesome, so I'm happy with that in this case, but...
It's interesting. I liked a lot of this film, but we've given it 2 stars, and I can see why we gave it 2 stars. But it's certainly, who knows, maybe a three and a half hour director's cut in a couple of years' time, would be very interesting to watch indeed. Also out this week, we have the Belko Experiment, which is a action horror siege type thing written and produced by James Gunn. And it is about a group of American employees in an American branch of a firm in Bogota, Colombia, who get locked in their building and told by a disembodied voice that they have to turn on each other, they have to kill each other in order to stay alive, or they will all be killed by a chip that's been implanted in their heads that will blow up their heads. Yes, it's Battle Royale. Yes, very much Battle Royale. Yes, it's Hunger Games. I really like the first half of this movie until it becomes a little bit more straight-laced and perhaps lacks some quirks and some humour and some surprises in the second half, which becomes a bit grueling and gore-tastic. If you like that sort of thing, which I do, it's fine. If you don't, you may find this a bit of a drudgery. So 3 stars for the Belko Experiment. 3 stars also for Jessica Chastain and Nico Caro's The Zookeeper's Wife. 4 stars for the horror film that none of us have seen, sadly, The Transfiguration, which sounds really interesting. And 2 stars for Katherine Heigl's return to the big screen in Unforgettable. 2 stars for Katherine Heigl's return to the big screen in Unforgettable. 2 stars for... No. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Please vote for us. Why wouldn't you after that link in the British Podcast Awards Listener's Choice Awards? They are, I think, voting finishes next week. So get those fingers clicking, people. And do listen now for the Warren Beatty special, the interview special, which is out now. And join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by Neil Gaiman, the genius behind American Gods. Until then, it is goodbye from John.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to watch Fast and Furious 8 with John Fergo. It's going to be quite a grueling grind. There's a lot of bald men in that movie. He's going to be really confused. Where's the cue ball going? Well, he's going to New York. Where's the cue ball going? He's going to New York as well. John, oh, for the love of God.
I think our award chances have just...
yeah, congratulations to Wittertainment on winning the Listener's Choice Award. Thank you for listening. See you next week. Bye.